St. Paul's Public Schools. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you are ready, just approach the microphone. You can adjust the microphone and the podium to your level. And please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Leslie Lieneman, on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you.
Good morning. We're here today on Sarah Dickhausen's case against her former school district. Sarah Dickhausen was a teacher, as you know, in a school called OWL, Open World Learning. Open World Learning is a school within a public school district, but it is not an open school. It is actually a school that admits students based upon admissions preferences, including giving preference to children of teachers in the school district and siblings of students already existing. The result of that, in part, is that it has a racial balance in students much different than the rest of the district, and that reality is at the heart of the case. I want to just first start with saying there are aspects of this case on which the parties in the district court agree. This is a Minnesota Human Rights Act reprisal case. The Minnesota Human Rights Act's reprisal provision includes as protected conduct the association of a person, one person, with a person of another race.
And so that is not, there's no dispute that there was an association with a minority group.
Yes, and so we've agreed on sort of the first two elements. There was protected conduct. There was adverse action, obviously. She was let go through non-renewal. And so the argument here between the parties is the element of causation in a retaliation case. And in Minnesota, the Supreme Court has made clear that retaliation or retaliatory motive need not be the sole reason for an adverse employment action, but rather it need only be one motivating factor. And that is, I think, a key legal distinction in this case. The defense, I think, wants to argue that there are grounds on which a jury could find in its favor. And at the summary judgment stage, that's really not the question. At summary judgment, we only ask, are there facts on both sides? The Minnesota legislature has included a jury trial provision in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And so when there are facts on both sides, inferences are drawn in favor of the non-moving party, and we send the case to the jury.
But I think you make a big argument about the timing of her non-renewal. And as to the, if the only fact is the timing, isn't the law that in and of itself is insufficient alone?
Timing can be sufficient. It depends on the length of time. Timing is one method of showing causation. It's not the only method, and in this case, timing is not the only evidence. Timing is part of our evidence, and it should not be considered in a vacuum. It should be considered, as you said, in conjunction with other evidence, and that is what we're talking about here. And, you know, with the summary judgment standard, we all want to give the benefit of the doubt to teachers and administrators in school districts because they have a hard job and issues of race are difficult in our society. But at summary judgment, the benefit of the doubt goes to the plaintiff and not to the defendant's evidence. And so I'd like to talk just a little bit about some of the evidence that I think the district court erred in its review by essentially giving the benefit of the doubt to the principal of the school and school's administration rather than giving the doubt to the evidence of the plaintiff. I'd like to talk just about the school district's measurement system in measuring teachers. They have what they call SAT evaluations. Ms. Dickhausen had been in a previous school and had undergone three SAT evaluations. Her prior year had been evaluated in the prior school as proficient.
That's irrelevant, isn't it, under the law?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that irrelevant? I mean, the issue is not how she did at the other school. The issue is how she did at this school. And I think as I recall the case law, I think we're supposed to focus on that.
I think what's important is the context in developing toward tenure. In other words, the way the teacher evaluation process goes, there is these steps that proceed toward tenure. And the tenure decision is in the end of the third year, by which time they would like teachers to be proficient. And so the proceeding of first year, second year, third year set evaluations, I think, is important as context. So when we get to the second year set evaluations, the first one done at OWL by Principal Gundale is done in November, and she's given a developing rating. January 11th, she sends her email where she talks about a racial divide among the students, and the next day, there's an unannounced set evaluation. And then the set evaluation in January of 2016, I think, is the one that the defense relies on the most, and the district court did also. In that set evaluation, even though if you look at the numerical evaluations, she was given far more proficient and developing standards than below standards, she was given a below standard rating. But what's important is that Gundale started the conversation by saying, let's talk about your email. Minnesota is a white state, OWL is a white school, and that's not a bad thing. And then he tells her she's not a good fit and suggests that she go teach at two more racially diverse schools. During that same time frame, the PAR
I'm sorry, the email specifically said she's not a good fit?
I'm sorry, not the email. That was in the conversation.
Okay.
They had a conversation where he provided her the set evaluation, and this is what he said to her during the evaluation. Again, that's an inference that has to go in favor of my client. He, of course, denies saying those things.
Right.
So then we go on into March and the timing of the third set evaluation. The third set evaluation is markedly different. The third set of evaluation is done in April. She's given a developing rating. She's got 39 proficient categories, 59 developing, and only one below standard. The testimony by Principal Gundale was that his expectation by the end of year two was that the teacher be developing toward proficiency. I believe a jury could conclude, based upon Gundale's own set evaluation, that she was developing toward proficiency. Based upon the totality of all of her set reviews taken together. However, the emails from...
But I mean, she was going down, not up, right?
Well, she was going up. So she has been in, if you compare where she was
in November... In the overall ratings, was she ever rated proficient for in each one? In each of the overall bottom line evaluations, was she ever rated proficient?
In the second year?
Yes.
No, and that was
at
not...
At this school?
And that was not the expectation. The testimony was that by the end of the third year of teaching, at the time of tenure, they should be rated proficient. The expectation was not that they be consistently rated proficient in the second year. It was between developing and proficient. And that testimony is in the record. The issue comes...
But I mean, are you saying she could never have been terminated in her second year?
That she could never have?
Are you saying under their evaluation system, she could not have been terminated in her second year because it has to go to a third year?
No, I'm not saying okay. She could never be terminated. What I am saying is that there's a departure from their normal practice, and there's a credibility issue with Principal Gundale because by his own standard, not my standard, but by his standard, she was in the developing category. She had 39 proficient categories, and by his own standards, she was developing in the way that he expected.
Well, could I ask you this? Because one of the points that were made by the respondents in the briefing is that some deficiencies are weighted more heavily than others. And I think there's a paragraph in the brief on page 41 of the brief that indicates that some deficiencies are more problematic than others and that your client struggled in some of the fundamentals of teaching, completing lessons, keeping students focused, and differentiating or teaching to engage all of our students. So I think at least the criticism of her was that she had problems in the classroom, in the actual teaching environment. I mean, doesn't that, I mean, what, what's your response to that? Because
yes, I think that lies again in the summary judgment standard. That's one construction of the evidence. But also, when we ask Principal Gundale, where do you expect them to be between developing and proficient, and she is, I think that is important evidence upon which a jury could say, no, wait a minute, you give them 3 years. She's had, even by your standards, she's had marked improvement from January to April. She's between proficient and developing. She's proficient in 39 categories. Why would you discharge her at that point when she's trending in the direction that you say that you need her to trend and she's meeting your benchmark? That is a construction giving all inferences drawn in favor of the plaintiff, giving her the benefit of the doubt. Again, we're just looking at, is there evidence on both sides here?
You use the term discharge. Now, she wasn't really discharged. She was actually just not renewed, correct? Is there a distinction?
It's a distinction without a difference under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, because either one would be an adverse employment action. Not renewing is an adverse employment action. So we could use the word adverse employment action instead of discharge or non-renewal, but legally there's no difference under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So having gone through the SET evaluation, the critical period I think is in March. And there are emails that are at the heart of this dispute. She goes to a diversity training in March 9th and 10th, and she openly talks about racial inequities in the school. And the very next day sends an email to Principal Gundale, and the very next day he starts emailing with the assistant superintendent Teresa Battle. This is the email chain in which he says first he would wait until the SET evaluation, but he's recommending non-renewal. If you follow the email chain through, by the end, he's at the PAR and I agree on non-renewal at this point. So even though I asked him several times in his deposition, when did you make the decision? When did you make the decision? He testified he didn't make the decision until April, when clearly there's a decision in March. Interestingly, the text communications with Brett Asselson in the PAR.
But, you know,
April.
I mean, I guess I mean, he's saying, you know, she's not doing well, but we are going to wait. I mean, you sort of view that as, well, that's when the decision made. But I mean, I think as I read that, it was, you know, she's got one more shot, so let's see. But, you know, as of now, she's not doing well. I mean, wasn't that true? I mean, at the end of the day, she seemed, because this was social studies, and as Judge Hooten has pointed out, she seemed to have problems related to the fundamental aspects of teaching, you know, completing the lessons, keeping the students focused, and more importantly, you know, I mean, I think her main problem was, you know, just, and you know, she obviously has a good heart, but if you're there to teach social studies, you can't just keep letting students come in and, you know, particularly the ones that aren't in your class. I mean, isn't that a problem under this evidence? I mean, you're trying to prove pretext, but it seems to me there's evidence in the record to support the decision that this was not based on, the facts that you're suggesting.
Well, that's not the question. The question isn't whether there's evidence in the record to support the defense side. The question is whether there's evidence on both sides. And yes, there were disruptions in her classroom, and she complained repeatedly.
Well, I mean, once they have a non-discriminatory reason, doesn't it shift back to you to prove that that was illegitimate?
No, we don't have the burden of proof at summary judgment. We have the burden to show that there's evidence on both sides. And if you look at the evidence and you read the entire record, one of the issues that she repeatedly raises is not just that there were blacks, and this is part of her protected conduct, there were black students seeking refuge in her class, but Gundale was also allowing white students to leave her class because they did not want to do her work. And his sort of giving his stamp of approval on that was causing some of the issues. So that is, there's an argument that that's her teaching style. There's an argument on the other side that says that's endemic of what was going on in the school and the race relation problems that were going on in the school. Again, with respect to the email, there one construction is, well, he's saying he's going to wait, but by the 18th, not only does he say he's not going to wait, Teresa Battle says she's not going to come because the decision was agreed upon by the PAR and by Gundale. Now, according to the PAR's text to...
I thought she didn't have to come if she agreed with it. I thought there were some suggestions that if she disagrees with it, she comes, but if she doesn't, if she does agree with the decision, she doesn't have to come. Is that correct?
Actually, if you look at the email, it's if the PAR and Gundale agree. But if you look at the communications between the PAR and Ms. Dickhausen, even in April, she hears through a student she's going to be non-renewed. She contacts the PAR, and the PAR tells her Gundale hadn't said that to him. So there's evidence on the record that that representation of Teresa Battle wasn't even true, that that was false. And so Teresa Battle didn't, Teresa Battle didn't decide not to come because of her own evaluation. She decided because of the representation of the principal.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Sarah Bushnell, and I represent the St. Paul Public Schools, the respondent in this matter. I urge you to affirm the district court. The district court judge did a careful application of the summary judgment standard to the facts that were presented in this case. And when you apply that standard, there is no admissible evidence in this record to show that the school district acted for any reason other than the legitimate teaching deficiencies that Ms. Dickhausen had. And as you have seen, the record is it is lengthy and significant in terms of those teaching deficiencies, which were observed by the principal, by her PAR coach, by students who complained that there wasn't enough rigor in her class, by parents who complained throughout the year that there were issues in her class.
Well, can I ask you this? Because, and I'm going to paraphrase what I think the argument is she is saying that, all right, I had 59 developing elements, 39 proficient elements, and one element that was below standard. And that was that instructions are unclear or disorganized. So I was told that as long as I was somewhere in that developing proficient level that I was doing okay. So those are the facts that they're emphasizing. Why is this appropriate for summary judgment in light of we have to view that evidence in a light favorable to her.
Right. So I would say several times the record has been characterized as saying that Principal Gundale testified that that employees needed to be between developing and proficient at the end of the second probationary year. What he actually said, and this is page 19 of his transcript, is end of second year weighted heavier towards proficient with some developing. And so we have the reverse here. At the end of Ms. Dickhausen's third year, she had 20 more elements that were developing than proficient. And in addition to that, in the middle of the year, she had been had an overall rating of below standards. And as Judge Connolly pointed out, the elements are not all rated the same. And some of the issues that she struggled with throughout the year that the principal and the PAR coach had tried to address with her, with some success, but not enough success, were some fundamental things related to classroom management and the ability to keep students on track and focused, the ability to keep herself focused so that at the end of the year, when the PAR coach is presenting to the Peer Assistance Review Board, which is another level of review beyond the principal's recommendation. He is explaining to the Peer Assistance Review Board that part of the problem was that students had learned how to get her off track so that we're not focusing on the lesson anymore. And of course, effective learning can't happen when that's the case. One of the things that I want to point out, and I think that Judge Connolly really focused on this in his questions, in the reply brief and in the argument this morning, there has really been a focus on causation, but that is part of the prima facie case. And we, for the reasons set forth in the brief, we don't think that timing is sufficient. We don't think that additional evidence is present beyond the timing, and so we don't think that a prima facie case is present. But even if so, again, the evidence in the record that there was a legitimate reason for the non-renewal of this contract is voluminous and went through several levels of review with many different eyes. And there is simply no evidence in the record that shows that that wasn't the real reason or that the real reason was actually a retaliatory reason. And finally...
So, Ms. Bushnell, in your mind, is the stronger argument that there is no causation or relating to pretext?
I think they're both very strong, but the appellant has focused in the reply brief and in the argument today on causation. And I guess what I'm saying is, even if you were to find that a prima facie case was present, I don't think that you can get past the fact that there is no evidence in the record to show pretext. As to timing, the district court made a finding that that I would like to draw to your attention. The district court found on page 4 of the decision that Ms. Dickhausen has explained that, quote, her association with black students was a state of being from the first day of her employment at Dowell through the last day she taught at Owl. That comes from Ms. Dickhausen's testimony. That's what she said during her deposition. And even to the extent that you were going to consider timing, that significantly undermines any ability of Ms. Dickhausen to tie a close relationship between the protected conduct of associating with black students, which began in September, with any of the things that she complains about in March, April, and June, when her contract was ultimately non-renewed. Subject to questions of the panel, that's all I have.
I hope I pronounced this right. Ms. Linneman, you know, points to two points on summary judgment that are obviously in her favor. So as to the conversation, the email, we draw all reasonable inferences in favor of her client. And then second, she pointed out that, well, even if there's, I don't have the case in front of me, but I'm sure we all know what we're talking about, you know, even if there's a non-discriminatory reason for her, and I don't know, I agree with Judge Smith, you know, her failure to get past the probationary period, you know, as long as that's one motivating factor, you know, as opposed to, you know, her alleged deficiencies, you know, that's enough to get you beyond or to defeat summary judgment. So how do you respond to that argument, Ms. Bushnell?
So taking first the email from Principal Gundale, I don't think that you can reasonably infer from that email that what he was saying is a decision has been made now. If that had been true, why bother going through the rest of the year? You know, as Dr. Battle testified, we do sometimes terminate probationary teachers during the school year. That's the urgency for our students, is what she said. And so if the decision had actually been made, I think she's done. That's not what happened. It's undisputed that there actually was another review, that the final review was considered by Principal Gundale, who didn't make the non-renewal decision to recommend until a week after that, on April 22nd. from there, his recommendation went to the Peer Assistance Review Board, who considered all three of the set evaluations, including that third one. And then it went to the assistant superintendent, who testified that she reviewed all three of the set evaluations. And those were similarly available to the superintendent and to the board. And so there's just no dispute in this record that the decision was not made to non-renew her contract until after the third evaluation, and that that third evaluation was considered. With respect to pretext, certainly Ms. Dickhausen has the opportunity to present evidence to show that the real reason, or one of the reasons, as you said, was retaliation for her association with Black students. But there just isn't any admissible evidence in this record from which that inference could occur.
Why not? Explain that to me. I mean, you know, she's got the conversation where he supposedly said that, and you know, we believe that's true. So why isn't that conversation between the principal and Ms. Dickhausen enough?
And I just want to make sure, are you asking about the where he said that Owl is a white school,
yes,
and you
yes,
have to
yes,
teach the
exactly.
white students?
Yes, yes, yes.
So the first response to that is, again, I don't know how any reasonable inference could be taken that what he was saying is that you shouldn't associate with Black students, or I'm upset with you for associating with Black students. More importantly, Ms. Dickhausen's testimony was that association with Black students was the one thing that Principal Gundale ever praised her for, and that he praised her for that repeatedly throughout the year in the written set evaluations, after the protest at the end of the year, and throughout. You can see in the March email exchange, about which we've had so much conversation, that that is one of the points that he makes to the assistant superintendent and to the human resources person in Ms. Dickhausen's favor, is that she does have such compassion and help for students, and that she builds relationships so effectively. And Ms. Dickhausen testified that she understood that to be particularly in reference to the African-American students. Again, in I believe it's in March, that the Courageous Conversation email, as it has been called, when she asks to run a session for African-American girls, and he lauds that passion and tells her that other teachers are doing a session like that with those girls, are specifically focused on them, and urges her to coordinate with them to do that. And so I just don't think there is any evidence in this record from which you could find that Principal Gundale had animus against her association with Black students, primarily based on her own testimony.
Let's assume for a moment that the Principal Gundale has a bias against the teacher because she associates with Black students.
Right.
And he goes to the review board, the peer review board, with that attitude. Isn't it almost a rubber stamp for the peer review board to follow the recommendation of the principal?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say the evidence just doesn't allow for that in this case. Principal Gundale did not attend the peer assistance review board meeting. The peer assistance review mentor, who is not based at OWL, he has teachers assigned to him throughout the district. He went to the peer assistance review meeting, and he presented Ms. Dickhausen's, the recommendation that Principal Gundale had made. He explained that he agreed with it. His notes show what he shared about the observations that had been made about her teaching. And remember, he, the peer assistance review mentor, had been in all three of the observations throughout the year and had independently concurred with those. And so it goes before that review board, which then can ask questions about the legitimacy of the criteria. And then beyond that, it goes to the assistant superintendent. And again, there's really no evidence, as I recall, that Principal Gundale is involved in any way in that, other than to respond to questions that she has, to provide the reviews that he offered. And then she does her own gathering of information, which includes offering a meeting to Ms. Dickhausen so that she can state her case. When that is declined, she had a lot of emails, including a 19 or 21 page letter email from Ms. Dickhausen. She considered all of that information independently together with the set of ALs from the prior year. So lots of independent and additional information that would make it very difficult for any animus that Principal Gundale had to infect the final decision.
Okay. You said there was no evidence, but there is some evidence that he made some statements that were, one would perceive as racially motivated. Is that not true in the record?
Well, he made some statements according to the evidence. Right, yeah. Right. Taking the evidence in Ms. Dickhausen's favor, he made some statements about OWL being a white school, right, and Ms. Dickhausen needing to teach to white students as well as the minority students. But again, that would have to be tied in some way to her protected conduct, and that's the piece that is really missing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question? In the final review evaluation, how did that compare to the other evaluation she had earlier in the year?
Yeah, good question. I have 3 seconds left. May I respond?
Please go ahead. Thank you. Ms.
So at the beginning of the year, she had an overall rating of developing, and I don't remember the precise breakdown of the elements. In the second review, the overall review was below standard, and she had that review was the worst of the three. In the third review, she had improved from the winter and was no longer below standard. The overall rating was developing, but she had 20 more developing elements than proficient elements, which was the reverse of what they were looking for at the end of the second year.
And is it?
Go ahead.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that if there hasn't been sufficient progress, that a teacher would be subject to non-renewal? Notwithstanding, she was still just in year two of her probationary period.
Well, I think what the record shows is that is a judgment call that is made by the principal. So if she's not up to standards, but she's close, I think that the principal would have the ability to put everything together and recommend renewal. And then again, that would go through the peer assistance review board and so forth. But in this case, I think the view was that it was not close. And so his recommendation was non-renewal, and that went through the process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
I would like to address your question concerning whether this is a rubber stamp process. Principal Gundale testified that in his entire career as a principal, he only made one recommendation for non-renewal. That was Sarah Dickhausen. He also testified that the recommendations that he made throughout his career had never been anything but approved. In other words, anytime he made a recommendation for any teacher for renewal, that teacher was renewed. The one time he made a non-renewal recommendation, she was not renewed. I'd also like to talk about this supposed independent investigation by Teresa Battle.
Maybe they just trust his judgment. I don't know.
Precisely.
But you're suggesting that's nefarious. I mean, that could also be an indication of someone who's a trusted evaluator, and as opposed to simply,
That is exactly what I'm saying, is that they trust his evaluation, so if his evaluation is tainted, there's no examination of that. Again, where is the construction on summary judgment? Benefit of the doubt goes to the plaintiff. I would like to talk about Teresa Battle. There's some critical testimony in her deposition. As was just noted, Ms. Dickhausen sent emails to her on May 1st and May 15th outlining some of the racial conversations she'd had with David Gundahl. Teresa Battle sent her an email indicating that she was not going to make her decision until the investigation of Gundahl's conduct had been completed, except there was no investigation. Dave Gundahl testified he was never spoken to as part of an investigation, and when I went through some of the allegations with Dr. Battle in her deposition, she indicated those allegations were not investigated. So it's easy to find no substantiation when you don't look. Again, the trusted evaluator, Dave Gundahl, his recommendation is given the benefit of the doubt by the superintendent, not an independent investigation. The other thing that's important here is causation. Evidence of pretext is evidence of causation, but we have to remember the standard here, which is motivating factor. And Teresa Battle testified specifically that the letters she received from the parents, the letters of outrage that Sarah Dickhausen had made allegations of racial inequities against the school and against Principal Gundahl, those letters played a part in her decision to approve the non-renewal. That's critical under the legal standards set forth by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's also critical to read Dave Gundahl's deposition. David Gundahl testified that he was upset and that other teachers in the school were upset that the black students viewed Sarah Dickhausen as their voice because they felt, and he felt, as though that undermined their own contributions. I don't have to say that he has nefarious intent, but if her being viewed by the students as their voice infected his decision making, that's a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We all are a product of our society, and no one is here, is, I don't believe, my client isn't, and I'm not saying these people are evil. I'm saying that these racial issues infected the employment decisions that were made about my client, and that's specifically true of Teresa Battle. And what's also important is those letters of outrage from the parents, Ms. Dickhausen did not know about them until after discovery was concluded in this litigation. She was not given the opportunity during the review process of Teresa Battle to address concerns raised by parents about her. And so there again, there was a lack of investigation, a lack of independent investigation by Teresa Battle, defaulting to they simply trusted in Principal Gundahl. And remember, it's not just Sarah Dickhausen who's saying Principal Gundahl made these statements. Students, we put evidence in the record, say he made those comments. The former assistant principal posted on the Safe Sarah website that she saw these inequities as well. So to suggest that reasonable people don't disagree here, it simply isn't the case. Reasonable people at the school felt the same way as Ms. Dickhausen.
Can I just ask you this? Because you seem to be making an argument, and I guess I need to understand. The decision was made that she was not progressing sufficiently in her probationary period, as evidenced by the third review, where she had more developing than proficient, and one below standards evaluation. What evidence is there that evaluation was somehow in error because of some retaliatory animus?
First of all, I think that...
I mean, particularly in light of the fact that she admitted that some of these things were going on that she was criticized for, and such as being distracted in the courtroom or in the classroom.
I think that the question itself gets to the heart of the matter. In other words, you're saying the decision was made that her teaching was lacking. That is one construction of the evidence. I think a different construction of the evidence, given his comments and the evidence taken as a whole, was that in January he said to her, "You're not a good fit here. I think you'd do better at these two other schools," naming racially diverse schools. He also said, "I think you'd do better as a social worker." And so when you look at the final set evaluation and you see that she is developing and proficient in every category but one, if you take that into context with his statements, this is a white state, It's a white school. That's not a bad thing. I don't think you're a good fit for this school. In the context of a clearly racially charged communication, that evidence taken together could simply be evidence that Dave Gundel thought she was not a good fit at OWL because of her association with the students, particularly in light of his testimony that it upset him that the students thought she was the voice for them because he felt like it undermined his own contributions. That's what he said in his deposition. I think you must read the evidence as a whole, and if you do, you will see that her association with black students infected the evaluation of her teaching and the decisions made with respect to her renewal.
Did you have another question?
But what evidence is there in the record that disputes the fact that she was having issues in the classroom?
Well, the set evaluation itself, I mean, she's got one below, by the third evaluation, she's got one below standard. Everything else is developing and proficient. To suggest that out of, is it 99, I think, out of 99 categories, that if you knew nothing else and you read that, I don't think you would get the impression. I don't think a jury's required to make the conclusion that that is a failing teacher. And that's really the standard here. If a jury could look at that and say, this looks like a developing teacher, summary judgment's not appropriate. They might look at that and say, I think this is a failing teacher. The defendant is free to argue that. But that's not susceptible to summary judgment. There's evidence on both sides here, and this is why we have juries. So I ask you to reverse the trial court and send this to the jury.
I had one question more. Ms. Lehman, you said Battle did not do any investigation. You know, and I'm looking at the respondent's brief, page 26, and they write, in addition to Dickhausen's correspondence in the 2015-2016 set evaluations, Battle requested copies of the more favorable 2014-2015 set evaluations and reviewed comments from teachers and parents that were both supportive and Dickhausen and that were critical of her. So what more investigation are you saying Battle should have done?
The email exchange that I'm referring to, if you look at the May 1st and May 15th email, it's from my client to Assistant Superintendent Battle. I'm talking about a failure to investigate Sarah Dickhausen's allegations that these racial statements were made and that they infected her evaluation. What Teresa Battle says to her is, I'm not going to make a decision until the investigation is concluded. But those allegations were not investigated. So that's what I'm referring to. The other piece of that
in part because she had scheduled a meeting with your client, and then your client said she wasn't going to meet her because she was going to seek legal counsel. So, I mean, presumably the best source of these comments was talking to your client. And I understand why at that point she decided to go the legal route. But there were two people in this conversation.
No, there were three.
Talking about the conversation where the principal and your client had the conversation. Okay, you're saying there was another person there?
Yes, Brett Asselson, the PAR, was there. And so when there's an email exchange where Sarah Dickhausen says to Teresa Battle, have you spoken with the PAR? Teresa Battle says yes. In her deposition, I asked her what she meant by that, and the only communication she identified was just about scheduling. Teresa Battle did not speak to Brett Asselson, who was in that January set evaluation where the comments were made, to find out whether he heard the comments or not. So there was a third, as close as you could get to an independent party, which perhaps the PAR was not, but certainly there was a third person available who could have been interviewed.
And does this person, is his deposition in the record? And what does he say? Does he say this happened?
His deposition is in the record.
Okay.
He denies hearing the comments, but there are emails after the meeting, before the non-renewal, in which Sarah Dickhausen writes to the PAR, Brett Asselson says she's upset about the comments that were made in the meeting.
Okay. Thank you. The matter is...